Vista to go into orbit around Vista and leave Vista and go into orbit around Sirius. But the 1,000 pounds of Xeon fuel is starting to run low, and they needed to keep the orbit stable around Sirius. And what happened is they lost control because they have these momentum wheels that could change the attitude of the spacecraft, and they had four, eventually two failed, and they've been using up a lot of hydrazine to keep it in position, you know, for doing its work, taking its pictures and sending information back to Earth. But now that hydrazine is starting to run out, so they're bringing it to a much lower orbit. I've just seen a picture of 22 miles above the surface. So it's doing quite well. It was launched back 11 years ago, I think 2007. So very successful project. But I think that's going to be coming to an end. And from what I understand, it'll remain in orbit probably for the next probably 100 years or so around that asteroid Sirius. But now without giving a lot more science that Roy talked about earlier. Okay, we had an EVA that was done last Thursday, and by Drew Fusel and Ricky Arnold. They went out and relocated a couple of cameras, and you know, it sounds like an easy job, but it took around almost 7 hours, you know, what could be involved with moving a couple of cameras around, these high-definition cameras. More than just the cameras, actually, that was the easy part. The running the cables, the power cables, the data cables, everything they need to do, they have located it to a certain spot on the International Space Station, up near the front of the space station, off the Harmony node, which is connected to the PMA-1 and PMA, correction, PAM-2 and PMA-3 adapters, their pressure mating adapters. That's what's going to enable future crewed vehicles to dock with the space station. So you're going to have both of them located on the Harmony module, one facing forward and the other one facing facing toward the Earth. One facing forward and one, correction, one facing toward the port side. So they need cameras. What took them 7 hours to do to relocate, to actually install these two cameras and relocate a lot of wires and cables. And, everything's getting jammed, packed up there. To do it is not an easy task. So it's part of that EVA. But it was successful. They did what they had to do. And then next time the Dragon crew vehicle goes up, which probably will be maybe the end of this year or the beginning of next, with a crew, or the Boeing Starliner, again, with a crew, they'll be able to see everything, every move they make as they approach the station and dock autonomously. And while we're talking about cameras, the ARRL, AMSAT, has a camera, a digital camera on board the space station. It's been up there, I believe, since May. They used it a couple of times. It's a digital camera. You know, they call it the Space Station Digital Amateur Radio TV System transmitter, but it was defective after a couple of uses. And now they've tried fixing it, doing whatever they can, and they've come to the conclusion it's not working out. They cannot do it. Camera is going to have to be sent back, and they'll probably send it back on the next Dragon flight that goes up there. The Dragon is the only one that can dock with the space station and then undock and come back and bring science experiments back, and also things like cameras and space that have to either be repaired or don't work anymore. Last time around, they brought back Robonaut 2. Came back with the Dragon. So that's the story on the ISS. A week or two ago, we talked about Chandra's telescope, space telescope. I was talking to Dick a lot about it. That's one that receives X-rays from the universe. And that's still doing good work. It was launched in 1990. They're looking to eventually replace it. But they released some science relating to one of the things it does. Every couple of weeks, it takes pictures of Alpha Centauri. Alpha Centauri is the nearest star to Earth, roughly 4.5 light years away. And that's the one that they found recently, a planet going around. And that planet happens to be in the Goldilocks position. They think it might have a little too much radiation from the local star, so they're trying to look at the other two stars located in the Alpha Centauri system. It's a star system. They have three stars. So they believe that the radiation on the other two would be minimal, so if they could find a planet going around those two, that might be a future destination for mankind to think about in the far future. And of course, if they ever found a planet, another couple of planets there, they point their antennas, or they already have pointed their antennas in that direction, hoping that there's some kind of sentient being on board those planets that would possibly be able to transmit signals to Earth. But so far, no results has ever really been confirmed. We're still looking for intelligent life in the universe. But Chandra's doing good. 1990, all these years, made many, many discoveries. Let me drop it. Okay, this is WS2N, and another news topic that just came out. I first started seeing it a few weeks ago, but now it's changed in those weeks. They started talking about a dust storm. It looked like a big dust storm on Mars, and now it's grown tremendously. It's gotten to the point where they said about 10 days ago it was as big as 16 million square miles, and they gave an explanation of how big that would be. That would be like all of North America and Russia put together. That's how big this dust storm is, and it's right over one of our rovers, Opportunity. It's not all the way around to bothering our Curiosity yet, although you can tell that from the pictures on Curiosity, the other rover, that it's definitely getting dusty in that area as well. But Opportunity, the solar panel rover, is completely blocked out. It's like nighttime where it is. So it's gone from 600 watt capability with its solar panels down to, I think, something like 20 watts or below that now. The only thing on Opportunity that's running now is the clock, just a clock, just like your clock and your cell phone. That's it. And then every once in a while, every 24 hours or so on Mars, a little longer, but every Mars day, or sol, they call it, that goes by, it just wakes up a little bit. It tests everything. It can tell whether or not by the voltages, whether or not it has the capability of turning itself back on and sitting there waiting to recharge. Well, every day that goes by and that happens, every soul that goes by wakes up, looks at the voltages, and it knows the solar storm is still there, and it just goes back to sleep. And this could go on for, they said, many, many weeks. In fact, the storm is intensifying. It could go on for even a month or so. So, naturally, most people are worried about Opportunity. It's been doing great. When it was launched in 2004 with its sister rover, Spirit. That was a long time ago, and here we are in 2018, 14 years later. And it's still doing good. And a lot of the scientists think that it's got a shot, but I have read that a lot of them are worried. If it gets to the point where the clock stops working, it's history. That's what happened to Spirit. Spirit got stuck on a hill, and the Mars winter came along, and they couldn't get enough solar rays to the panels, and eventually the voltage got so low that Spirit eventually shut itself down, and that was it. Same thing could happen to Opportunity. The only good thing about the dust storm, it does go down. Normally it goes down to like, you know, minus 100 degrees or more on Mars. It's been going down to around minus 20 because of the solar storm. A lot of heat that has, you know, wound up on the ground does not get radiated out. It's kind of like a mini, what would it be called, when all the clouds are surrounding our planet, can't get the sun rays won't radiate out again, and you could have a greenhouse effect. That's what's happening now with Mars, so that means it doesn't have to warm itself up that much, and that might help. Does have a nuclear it's a plutonium-239 on board, keeping it a little warm, but it's not enough to really to do the job. It's enough to just keep it, you know, at temperature during the nights. The two solar rovers really don't work at night. Wouldn't have that capability. So that's the story on Opportunity. We'll hope it gets going. It was in the middle of another science investigation, and that has come to a grinding halt.
Let me ask you a quick question, Paul. Stand by. Spirit got stuck in a sand pile, and the solar panels were not in the desirable orientation, so it sort of died. Is Opportunity, are its solar panels in a desirable orientation so that once this dust storm is over, it stands a chance of coming back to life? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, Spirit was climbing Columbia Mountain. I think they had a name for it. And it was where it got stuck was on the side. It was having all kinds of problems. It had real bad wheel problems. It was, you know, the only way it could drive most of the time was backwards. It would just drag that one wheel. They could tell from the amperage on the reading from the wheel that, you know, it wasn't working anymore. The amperage was going way up when they turned it on, so they just shut it off, and they kind of just dragged it around. That's what I remember about Spirit. It lasted around 6 years, so here this thing is going 14 years, and yet the panels are okay. And then when the dust storm goes by, what tends to happen is the light winds that are up there, it's happened many, many times, so will actually clear off the solar panels. Many times that the panels get dusty, and they lose a lot of ability to see the sun, and then a little breeze comes by. In one case, a dust devil actually came by, and it just made the Spirit up, you know, completely like it just landed, and they had before and after pictures. So that was amazing. But yeah, Opportunity is in good shape if the solar storm clears. The solar storm is being caused.
You called it a solar storm. I think you mean dust storm.
Yeah, dust storm caused from the sun. Dust storm is being caused by the relative position of Mars. It doesn't happen every year, but, you know, Mars is in an elliptical orbit, and sometimes it gets relatively close to the sun. So when it does, and it happens to be summertime at the same time, that's when these dust storms get created. And you know what happens is the dust starts, and usually from the south, the southern area, the dust starts rising up, and you wind up with more winds when you get these different sunny and shady areas, which creates more dust, and it just, you know, it feeds on itself, and you can wind up with a global dust storm. That's what happened when Mariner 4, that first one up there, did a bypass, and it really saw nothing because it had a big dust storm. Mariner 4 or 9, I'll have to check. I'm pretty sure it was 4, though. But, and they had no results for, like, weeks on end. Couldn't take any pictures. I believe it was Mariner 9. When Mariner 9 first went into orbit, I could check on that. Same type of thing. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, very good. We've had a lot of launches, but lately they're foreign ones. You know, the Russians launched some, China's launched quite a few, and Japan launched one the other day as well. So, but the next big launch I'm looking for is the Parker solar probe. Yeah, that's going to go off at the end of July. July 31st is the scheduled launch for that. We're looking forward to Parker. Eventually, it's going to wind up going to the sun, like 6 years from now. We'll be talking about that. But just to get off the ground, it's going to have a dramatic launch from Florida on a Delta IV rocket. So that's pretty good. We'll talk more about that when that does launch next month. The Chinese have successfully put their Chang'e 4 relay satellite into the L2, Lagrange Point 2 of Earth-Moon relationship. So, you know, if we think of, you know, when we send a spacecraft out to the moon, oh, you know, you put it into orbit and that's it. It's not going around and around the moon. It's behind the moon, looking at the dark side the whole time. And it's roughly, I think it's 60,000 kilometers. I think it's like 39,000 miles, which is far. So, you know, the most, like when we send satellites up, astronauts, you know, orbit like 60 miles above the surface, that type of thing. This thing is like 40,000 miles away from the moon and behind the moon. It's just going to sit there waiting for another satellite or another spacecraft to come up by China, also called Chang'e 4. Chang'e 4 rover is going to land on the dark side of the moon. If they do that, that has never been done before. They're actually going to land the rover there, and then to do the telemetry and all the pictures and everything they need to do, because it's on the opposite side of the moon, and the moon never turns as far as we're concerned. We always see the same side. We would not be able to get those transmissions, so they needed a relay. So they got themselves a real repeater. All the way out at L2, sitting there waiting until November or maybe December for the other Chang'e 4 to go up. And then if that's all successful, another year or so, they plan on sending Chang'e 5, which would be a sample return mission.
Now, L2 is where we're going to put James Webb. So that's where the Chinese just put a satellite. And it's going to be a relay for the sample and return mission. Is that the main reason it's there, Paul? Go ahead. And why is another one going to go there?
Yeah, we're talking about two different Lagrange systems. There's Lagrange, Sun, Earth, satellite. You know, that would be, for James Webb. You'd have 1 million miles, past the Earth, That would be where James Webb will eventually go. So that would be Sun, Earth, you know, James Webb. This L2 position is Earth, Moon, Chang 4. So it's sitting behind the Moon, only 40,000 miles away from the surface, sitting there in a halo orbit. Nothing to do with the Lagrange, you know, they're both Lagrange points too, but you know, it's a different system. So that's what we're talking about. So they need a relay there, and this way when their lander goes up with a rover and lands on the dark side of the Moon, it'll be able to transmit up to this repeater that's there now and back to Earth. They'll be able to communicate on a regular basis. That's their hopes and dreams. Back to you, Dick.
I'm glad you cleared that up, and I've now got the picture. When it comes to putting a satellite over a fixed position on the Earth, we call that a geosynchronous satellite. Geostationary, geosynchronous. 22,300 miles above the Earth, and it always looks at the exact same point of the Earth. The equivalent of a geosynchronous satellite to the Moon is this L2 of the Earth-Moon system. So that satellite is going to stay above a fixed position of the backside of the Moon. Very fancy. Glad you cleared that up. Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, that's one of the places that they want, that NASA wants to put our deep gateway system. Also, where that satellite is. They plan on putting that thing out there 40,000 miles away. Also, when we launch the SLS system for the first time, whenever that happens, many delays on that, and that will go up unmanned at first, and that will also go out to that same location, one orbit. It just won't stay at that halo orbit and eventually come back to Earth. So it's an important location. We talk about sample returns. NASA is still working on a sample return for Mars, and they have a company that's Mastin is the name of the company. They're building they built a lot of rockets that can take off vertically and land vertically, and they built another one called Zodiac, and it's spelled with an X. So it runs on liquid oxygen and also isopropyl alcohol, believe it or not. That's their fuel. And they've successfully have flown this and landed it. Supposedly it's picked up dirt, you know, and wherever they've tested it. And then took off again. So they're testing that. What they would like to do eventually is land spacecraft on Mars, you know, have it come down vertically, and then pick up dirt samples, or you know, they've got some exotic plans. Really, you know, they've really got some far out plans. They would like to then send a rover and pick up different samples that the next rover that's going up in 2020 will eventually leave behind, and grab those samples and bring it back to this Zodiac rocket, put it inside, and have it launch from Mars and dock with the mothership. And of course, this is all unmanned, and then eventually come back to Earth with a heat shield on it, and have it land probably in Utah somewhere. That's usually where they do it. So, interesting setup. And I'm just surprised that they're concentrating so hard on this, because everything lately has been, they're pushing things for the Moon, but this thing looks like a Mars. I mean, you could use it for the Moon, but they won't need it. Let's see, one other topic I thought it would be interesting. I have never really talked about what DARPA wants. That's the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. They have a plan for a rocket that will take off vertically and come back and land on wheels. They need something that's reliable that they could put up in an instant, you know, for the military. You know, we've got all these military satellites flying around, and, you know, it's a possibility that, you know, someday they could be in jeopardy. You know, some country might decide to, you know, destroy one for some reason. Well, one might just get destroyed because something goes wrong, the batteries blow up or something, and it might need to be replaced immediately. DARPA wants to have the capability of replacing that immediately. So they have a space plane that they're building called the Phantom Express. And, you know, I read about the Phantom Express a while back, but it's been a long time since any news has come out about it. Aerojet Rocketdyne, you know, they're the ones that build their rockets for the space shuttle system and everything. They've taken the design of the main engine for the space shuttle. That engine was called the RS-25, you know, the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen system. And they've kind of shrunk it down a little bit, and they want to put on the Phantom Express one rocket, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And they're going to call it the AR-22 for, you know, Aerojet Rocketdyne. That's the name of the company. So it's the AR-22. But it's got almost 400,000 pounds of thrust. Where, you know, the shuttle had like 500,000 on just one engine. So this thing's up there pretty good. And plus, they'd be, you know, they have the capability of putting a solid booster rocket also attached to it.
CC Mobile.
And it would launch vertically and come back on wheels. That's the story on the Phantom Express by DARPA. Another station, go ahead. This is WS2N. Here's Paul.
WS2N, K1CC Mobile over here, west side in Manhattan. Just heading northbound on the Henry Hudson. How's the radio set in there?
Okay, doing very good. You've reached the net. We're getting toward the tail end of it. This is the TechNet. It's here every Sunday. So, you know, if you have any questions, right now we're in the space portion of that net. If you have any questions or comments, or you're just checking things out as you're driving around mobile.
Not very good. I didn't know it was a net. I was just heard you talking on here, and I just came off of 520. So, thanks for picking me up, and I guess I'll check in, AK1CT. Very good.
Okay, join us here every Sunday night from 8 o'clock till 12 o'clock, and we'll be here. We have a technical portion in the beginning, real electronics, real antennas, and then we have a physics and science portion of the net, and now we're up to the space portion of the net. One last topic is the Hayabusa 2. It was launched by Japan. NASA is... has a contribution. They're using their deep space network to communicate with this thing. This thing has gone out to an asteroid. Hayabusa 2 is from Japan, launched from Japan. And it's within a couple of days of going to orbit around this asteroid. The asteroid's about a half mile in diameter. On board, it's got a couple of other satellites attached with some are actually going to separate land on the asteroid and actually bring material back up to Hayabusa 2. It's also got an impact that they plan on eventually, sending this 4-pound rocket screaming into the asteroid and creating a little crater, and then picking up the dust, the dirt, whatever comes out of that, and collecting it and eventually bringing it back to Hayabusa 2. And this is going to go on for like a year and a half. Just reaching there now, it's got, you know, just small pictures of what the asteroid looks like now with cameras. But over the next year or so, it's going to be doing these different maneuvers. And hopefully, if it all works out, eventually they'll deorbit and come back to Earth in 2020, I think, or the end of 2020. And where they landed is out in Australia. You know, I mean, it was launched from Japan, and they need a land area to land these vehicles. But there was a Hayabusa 1 some years ago that did a similar type of project. It didn't work out. They had some problems with it. They had momentum wheel problems, and they had ion engine problems, a lot of problems. And it was all caused from a solar storm right after it was launched. It just happened to be at the wrong time, and I think it fried some of its circuits. So weird things started to happen. So they did manage to get some, I mean, we're talking about molecules and, you know, grams of stuff back from Hayabusa 1. This one plans on bringing back, you know, a lot more. A lot more advanced than Hayabusa 1. So wish them luck, and see if they can get some good samples back this time from that mission. And that's pretty much it, Doug. We'll send it back to you for any comments, questions, or anybody else that has any questions for the space portion of the TechNet. This is WS2N.
Yeah, let me back up on something here, Paul. I had the impression from what you're saying that China is doing a pretty serious effort of putting up a relay satellite at Lagrange Point number 2 of the Earth-Moon system. That's going to be relaying information as a craft goes to the backside of the moon, does a landing, sample collection, and then returns. In other words, it appears to me that they're putting forth a pretty serious effort not to send an astronaut to collect lunar material, but sending an unmanned mission to collect and return lunar material. I mean, in theory, China can say, hey, loan me some of the stuff that Apollo 11 collected, but they want to get their own stuff. Is that sort of what's going on here, Paul? And is this getting preparation for maybe a Mars mission of a later time? So right now, they're spending a lot of money to get a couple of pounds of lunar soil, if I understand it correctly. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yes, they are, but the main goal is sending astronauts, to the moon. But they've got to be able to fly there, they've got to be able to land there, and they've got to be able to get back. So, I think I combined two missions. I should have done that. It's actually three missions. This is the first part. There's Chang 4 and there's Chang 5. This Chang 4 has two parts. That's the relay one. That was successfully launched a month or so ago, and now it's just the Halo orbit at L2. Then the second half of Chang 4 will be launched. It's actually scheduled for November, but I'm guessing in December, but you know how things go. But when it gets there, it's going to land on the dark side of the moon. And it's going to have a rover, a little rover. It's going to go out and look at things and take pictures. That's it. That's not a sample return mission. Chang 5, that's the next one, probably a year or so from now. That will be a sample return mission. That will go out, land, and I don't think that's going to be on the dark side of the moon, but I don't know where that's going to go. But nevertheless, that will be the sample return mission. Let me drop it.
Yeah, stop right there. The rover that's going to be on the moon, you call it the dark side. It's really the back side. I mean, the back side of the moon is no darker than the front side. It's just a matter of what time of the month, what phase of the moon. For a rover to go on the surface of the moon and rove around and take pictures, and if it's going to be there for a total of a lunar day, let me drop this, it's going to have to tolerate a temperature of something like plus 150 degrees centigrade at high noon on the moon and minus 150 degrees centigrade at midnight on the moon. So I think you're telling me that this rover is not going to just last a couple of hours. It's probably going to try to last at least a lunar month, in which case it's got to have some pretty wicked protection mechanisms from that huge temperature extreme on the surface of the moon. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, they'll probably get the you know, go for the first, you know, 10, 12 days, you know, when it's daylight on the moon. And yeah, you, in fact, you can see pictures from the Chang'e 4 relay, you know, the moon's all lit up. Yeah, the dark side of the moon. All happens by heart. So yeah, there's plenty of light there for the solar panels, so whatever rover that lands will be able to drive around for a while and do whatever it has to do. Take pictures, you know, it might have a neutron spectrometer on it to help, you know, evaluate the minerals, the rocks. Whether it makes it through the lunar night or not, you know, I'm sure they got the fingers crossed. The 2013, when they went up, they also had a rover that landed on the front side of the moon, and that rode around in daytime. Everything was fine, but the lunar night, it looked like it killed it, but the next, you know, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, they did start getting signals back from it. It just, you know, the circuits were just not operating, but it was getting some kind of signals back. So, I'm not going to say it really survived. It kind of did. So maybe this one is going to be beaten up a little bit more. Maybe they'll put a piece of plutonium in it or something in there to keep the circuits warm. I haven't seen anything like that, but maybe they will. Back to you, then.
So the previous Chinese lunar rover didn't survive the lunar night. Has the United States put any lunar rovers on the moon that survived the lunar night, Paul? Go ahead.
No, we never did that. You know, we had equipment go up there. The surveyors, they survived the night. You know, six different surveys that landed. They weren't rovers. Some of those landed. And whatever we put up on, you know, when we landed there, what we left behind was these science packages. They kept operating. So, not sure. I'm trying to think. There's one other country. India. India's got to be launching another one this year as well, and they have a rover as well. Yeah, the goal is to eventually, they want to be able to land on the moon, pick stuff up, bring it back, have a heat shield that's going to survive 25,000 miles per hour, because that's how fast they're coming back with these ridiculous temperatures of 5,000 degrees. And they have to be able to see if they're going to, they can do that with rocks before they do it with people.
That makes some sense. Each of the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17, I think each of them essentially left the ALSEP packages, ALSEP, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package. And those things transmitted back a signal on S-band, and I think most of those ALSEP packages lasted a number of years, as I remember. So obviously they were designed to survive these ridiculous temperature extremes on the moon. I'm having trouble believing that way back in those days, they put a polonium heat source on board, so I wonder how they did that. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Except Apollo 11, 12, 13, 14, and when I say 13, I had it as well, because they were supposed to land, they all had RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators. They all did. So, that was the plan. In fact, that's what a lot of environmentalists weren't too happy about. When Apollo 13 came back, they used Aquarius, the LEM, to control everything. And then when the command module eventually separated, where did it separate? Right near Earth. You know, they got near Earth. They separated. The control module had to come on. Parachutes had to work. Everything had to be just right for those three to make it back safely. The LEM itself had separated, and where did that wind up? That wound up, you know, crashing into the Earth. On board that LEM, you know, so probably in the Pacific Ocean somewhere, is a container of plutonium for the RTJ. Environmental, we're not thrilled about that, but hey, what are we going to do? We got our guys back.
I thought each of the RTGs are in a very secure container that can survive reentry, Paul. Go ahead.
Yes, you know that. I know that. A lot of people on the net know that. But the, you know, the people that are, it's kind of like the cell phones, you know. Cell phone, I'm going to pick up a cell phone, I'm going to cause cancer to my ear, some weird thing's going to happen. No matter what you tell them, you know, that cell phone's going to kill them. And it's the same thing, you know, these things have been, I mean, these containing this stuff, I've seen them shoot missiles into it. You can't break these things apart, you know, it's incredible. They will survive anything. So, yeah, they did not break open. I know Russia had a problem, though. Russia, you know, I don't know. They had to have some kind of a problem, but they don't seal things the way we seal things.
Yeah, it seems to me that one of their missions, Soyuz or whatever, smeared some radioactive material across the tundra of Canada. Is that true? Go ahead.
Yeah, it was a Cosmos mission. No, they had a lot of Cosmos missions, satellite missions. And I forget the name, I can find it, but Cosmos with a number behind it. And they actually had a fission reactor going in space, you know. I mean, we want to do the same thing now, but I'm sure we'll do it a lot safer. But that came back, and like you said, right across a large area of Canada, and they were looking for pieces for a long time, trying to find every little piece. But, I mean, that type of news gets into the media, and, you know, I remember when Cassini was going up to Staten, and, oh, no, we can't do that. They were thinking about canceling that mission because it had plutonium on board.
And I think it had to do some flybys of the Earth in order to do boosting to get into the higher velocity to get to Saturn, isn't that true?
Yes, that's right. They worried when it was going to have the Earth get on gravitational assist. Suppose you miss, you know, not miss Earth, suppose you hit Earth. That was it. But that, you know, even if that came crashing in, you know, and hit land, whatever that container was supposed to be built to, you know, to handle any kind of a blast.
Okay, now the ALSEP, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages, deposited by the Apollo astronauts, contained an RTG, and that's what powered that thing. That's good for heating it up when it's cold during the lunar night. But the lunar day hit some ridiculously high temperatures. I'm now wondering how in the world they protect the circuitry from the hot temperature during the day. They must have painted it with some very reflective paint so that the sun didn't overheat the package. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, you remember, everything had that Mylar. Looked like aluminum foil all over it. That's what it looked like. Gold Mylar all over the lem. Remember that? And then everything was designed to reflect the heat. So, I think they got a good handle, at least NASA does, on how to control the heat cooling on the moon. I mean, there's a lot left to do. They're in the process right now of developing a 10-kilowatt nuclear thing that's just going to give off heat. It's not going to be plutonium, some other, I forget which other element. And it's going to move a Stirling engine. They've already done this. They've tested this in I think we've Ohio, where you know, they put it into a vacuum and everything, and they duplicate what it flies on the moon. And this thing is putting out 10 kilowatts there. And, I mean, I got a 4K generator here at home. I can't imagine this thing putting out 10 kilowatts, you know, over twice the amount that my gas-powered generator is doing. But that is quite the capability if they send that up to the moon.
Now, Now, that 10 kilowatts, is that primarily a heat generator, thermal, or is it also an electrical generator? How many kilowatts of electricity is that going to produce? And that device is being produced for what spacecraft, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, this will be put on the lunar surface, you know, eventually they want to, you know, eventually start some kind of a small base or, you know, that type of deal. You're going to need power, and, you know, as well as I know, you need something really good all through the lunar night. So this, I guess they're taking it out of the spacecraft, they're going to put it on the ground, they know what it looks like. This 12 thing with this big radiator makes it out of, sticking out of the top, but it's just heat, it's going to be generating heat. And I'm not sure if it's, you know, I think it's going to be some kind of a fission system. I missed it. You know, I didn't read the elements that they have in there. I'll have to look into that. But it's a nuclear, basically creating heat, because there's a Stirling engine. The Stirling engine works on heat. You know, you heat up the piston and it moves one way and eventually moves the other way. So it's heat that's moving the piston. The piston's going to drive either the generator or maybe, again, I haven't seen that close up either. I can't imagine, moving a generator, but maybe it's, you know, moving a magnet between, you know, in and out of a coil induction, an induction type of generator system. Who knows? I haven't seen that many details on it, but they did say it was a NASA site, so it's not YouTube or, you know, NASA is developing this thing, or has developed it.
Now, this thing runs 10 kilowatts. Is that 10 kilowatts worth of heat, which you and I can convert to BTUs, or is it 10 kilowatts of electricity by way of the Stirling engine that's running with this nuclear source? And the nuclear source is good for what kind of...
Repeater, timeout.
This nuclear source also is good for what kind of life? So what kind of life? Is it 10 kilowatts of electricity on the Stirling engine and heat simultaneously over here, Paul? And is this for a human habitat potential mission?
Yeah, you know, small little base, you know, probably four people or something on a little base. And then they said they'd be able to send more, and you create your lunar village. And yeah, 10 kilowatts of electricity. That's what I'm saying. I can't imagine this thing. I mean, my generator is putting out 4 kegs, you know. And this thing's putting out 10 kegs. And, you know, there was a picture. I can't tell how big it is. You know, I really need more information about what this is. I researched it a little bit, but couldn't find much on it. But it was on a NASA site, so. If it wasn't there, I'd say, well, maybe this is, you know, a lot of baloney, but they put it out, it's usually pretty good.
What do you believe is the half-life of the nuclear source, Paul?
No, I don't know. I'm sure it's going to be a lot longer than they need to be on that lunar base. I'm going to, you know, they're setting this up, you know, for years for a permanent base. So I don't think they're going to be bringing up, like, nuclear batteries to, you know, it's not going to run out of power anytime soon. Again, I don't know the elements. Once I find out the elements, I'll be able to tell you the half-life. It's not like plutonium has a half-life of, the one for the RTG has a half-life of 86 years, that I know. Whatever they're using here, I don't know yet. Back to you, Dave.
Your 4-kilowatt generator. I own a 4-kilowatt generator, which is a Winco. What brand name is yours, sir, Paul?
They call it PowerMate. It's really they cook off of Coleman.
Okay. The 10-kilowatt generator, is that something on paper, or do they have a working model of it already, and they're ready to go into production of these things, Paul? Go ahead.
I'll find it. One of my nets, I went over it briefly while back, so I'll find it. And, it's developed, and they've already tested it. And they tried different things. They tried shorting things out, breaking things, and they said, but whatever they did, they couldn't break it, you know. It sounds unbelievable. I mean, they beat the heck out of the thing to see if it would still keep running, and it does.
I don't know how many more days my email system server is going to be offline. Therefore, people can't mail me emails for the last 5 days and some number of days in the future. I hope they're going to fix that real soon, or my son will find an alternate. Okay, we're approaching the bewitching hour. Let me drop it.
What, you got a cable coming into the house? What are you doing? You got to be able to get out of the house on something right there.
I've got internet. I don't have email. My email server company in Georgia has died. And we're waiting for them to either fix the equipment or we're going to find an alternate email server. But I've got internet. But you can't send me an email for the next couple of days. It'll bounce, I think. Okay, that was TechNet number, that was Space Report number 304. You heard Science Report number 34, and TechNet number 1704. Oh, I forgot to put a zero in there. Be kind to each other, you guys. We'll be back next week. 73 for now. Bye-bye, Paul, and turn it over to Roy if he wants to say any final words. See you next week, all you guys, and thank you. AC2GS, K2.
Repeater, timeout.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. By the way, the kilopower generator uses uranium-235. There's a nice little Wikipedia entry on it. Just look up kilopower. And thanks to everyone for participating. If you want to contact me, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you want to look at any of the links of any of the topics that I was discussing tonight, just go to roy.ac2gs.com, and they're all active. So click away. And for everyone, enjoy Field Day coming up. Have a great time. And we'll all get back together again next Sunday. Until then, bye, guys.
Okay, very good. Thanks for looking that information up, too. Very good. We'll be back next week. 73 in... 1201. Looking at my UTC clock. 73 WS2 unclear.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the WQVL repeater.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. Tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.